بسم الله الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. ثم ما بعد التسليم. Today, inshallah, we will continue with our series on women in Islam. And in the previous talks, we talked about several issues. If we go backwards, we talked last time about the issue of female circumcision and the issue of concubines, the issue of polygamy, the issue of qiwama, which is the leadership of men over women, the issue of hijab, the issue of women's education, the issue of the testimony, the issue of the inheritance, the issue of just general comparison between the Quran and the Bible with regard to text pertinent to women. Today, inshallah, we'll talk about the issue of mingling between men and women, and this is considered to be segregation is used as an equal to alienation or oppression, and there is a difference between segregating people based on their socioeconomic class, based on their racial background, based on their national background, and segregating people based on their sex. There's a huge difference. Well, in our masajid, we as Muslims in our masajid, we never segregated people based on the socioeconomic class. We never had reserved seats for the most prominent in the front of the masjid. Whoever comes earlier gets to be in the first row. And if you come late, you're late. That's it. That's how the masjids are arranged. And so in some of our temples of worship, classically, traditionally, historically, they were reserved seats. Now, we don't have reserved seats in the masjid. The segregation that takes place in the masjid, to some extent, between the men and the women and outside of the masajid is completely different from segregating people based on their socioeconomic class or their status, racial or national background. There is a wisdom behind the distance that Islam asks of women and men to keep from each other to some extent. That is quite obvious, and we will go through some statistics at the end of this talk that will show the benefits of keeping that distance. I will start by those terms of recommendations. I'll start by making, putting them together, so I'm quite familiar with them, so I'll start by them. AMJA is the Assembly of Muslim Jurists of America. And these recommendations were from the last annual convention of AMJA in Montreal, Canada. You will find them on the AMJA website, both in Arabic and English as well. So the final recommendations, actually my paper on this, inshallah, will be published. So, but this is maybe the very, very summary of the paper. It says intermingling is a general term which includes that which is permissible and that which is prohibited. And among the former and the latter, there is that which is agreed upon and that which is debatable. So intermingling per se does not mean much until you define what you mean by intermingling. If the meaning thereof is merely men and women gathering in an open space to perform shared work, whether religious or not, that in itself is not prohibited as long as the Islamic code of behavior is followed in terms of hijab, lowering the gaze, etc. Example of such events or functions or activities that may require the coexistence of men and women, the gathering of men and women in masajid for the prayers around the landmarks of Hajj to perform the rites of pilgrimage and the like, also in religious lessons and study circles, whether in the masjid or elsewhere. Women going out to fulfill their needs in public places, noting that women must observe proper Islamic hijab and keep away from men while both men and women must observe the lowering of the gaze in order for this to be permissible. If, however, the meaning thereof is for men and women to socialize and mix together closely and freely, this follows the basic principle of prohibition. As long as there is no, you know, exigent need or necessity according to the criteria of Sharia, furthermore, needs are either clearly established in the textual proofs or derived by analogy. So certain needs that establish certain needs for intermingling were established in the textual proofs, such as the hadith that talk about, you know, men going, women going out with, you know, Prophet ﷺ and the companions out to the battlefield sometimes because they were needed, or going out to the market or so on. And there are things that could be derived by analogy. Among these is the need of the mujahideen for women to participate in battle, to dress wounds, to bring water to the thirsty, and so forth. This also includes a woman's need to get what she needs from the marketplace. Likewise, she has the need for legal actions, so it's permissible for her to attend court proceedings. There's also the need for Islamic preachers to make dawah to women, Islamic preachers to reach out to women, because there are not always female da'is in every place, including those who do not yet wear hijab, in an era of temptation and pressure, religious commitment, in addition to a variety of other needs. Like, he cannot afford to say, you know, I'm going to give dawah only to muhajjabat because of fitna. Because had we done this in the 60s, for instance, in Egypt, we would have been given dawah to 5% of the population. So certainly, the dawah needs to be carried, conveyed to the people. Those examples that have been mentioned above are no more than examples. This is not a comprehensive list. Particular emphasis should be placed on the importance of division between the sexes and education of the institutions. Junior high school, college, those are people in the peak of their sexual excitement. Therefore, it goes without saying that division between men and women in educational institutions would be more protective of moral values, farther removed from temptation, and more preemptive. It's also more conducive to concentration when seeking knowledge, a fact to which even educational institutions in Western societies have begun to pay attention. And certainly I'll show you the statistics and the news about this particular claim. When intermingling is allowable due to a necessity or considerable need, there are restrictions which must nevertheless be followed in all circumstances. Among these are lowering the gaze, avoiding indecency and foolishness, prohibiting seclusion and touching, preventing crowding and bodies being pressing on against the other, as well as keeping the awana covered and abiding by the Islamic code of behavior, which is an intrinsic part of hijab, because hijab for women is not just a piece of cloth that she wears. Hijab is a conduct, it's behavior. There are factors both restrictive and acceptive which affect this matter of intermingling. So it appears to us from examining the textual sources and facts of the Salaf or righteous predecessors that the issue of intermingling differs according to the age of both the men and the women involved, the nature of the situation, and the necessity for it, for mingling. In terms of age, there is somewhat of a relaxation in the matter of intermingling which comes with age, such as if a woman is so old that she no longer desires marriage, nor do men desire her, or if the man's hair has turned gray, white is literal. Which is no offense to anyone. But and he reached an extremely old age. In Arabic, this is "ista'ala ra'suhu shayba wa balagha min al-kibri atiyya." Maybe the literal translation is, but you know, in Arabic, this rhymes with the Quran for us, you know. It's Zakaria. When Zakaria asked for a child, then Allah told them, you will have a child. He said, how could I have a child when my head has turned gray? Gray has spread like fire in my head. And I reached extremely old age. So you use those in Arabic, and then you literally translate. Not literally, but eventually the translator is bound by the text. You know, the translator also cannot deviate too far away from the text. So it may not make perfect sense for the reader in English because it's a translated piece of text. After all, the translated piece of text will be bound by the logic of the source language. And languages have different logics. So the logic of the source language will be different from the target. In terms of the nature of the situation, scholars more strictly prohibit intermingling in case of entertainment and play, amusement, entertainment, play, such as weddings, as well as in crowded and chaotic situations such as funerals. Furthermore, the dangers of intermingling are greater when it takes place inside the home than when it occurs in public places. And I just heard the comment from a Jewish individual who said to me that I thought that the Jewish weddings are crazy, and I didn't realize how, you know, mild they are until I attended the Muslim wedding. I told him, you probably did not attend every Muslim wedding, because Muslim weddings would not be crazy, but certainly he must have attended, like, you know, a wedding of Muslims. Anyway, in conclusion, we must heed the precautionary measures taken to safeguard the moral values of Muslim society, which have been established by Islamic law, such as virtue, chastity, covering, and protection, while taking into consideration the need for men and women to interact in various spaces or spheres of life, as well as the need to enable a woman or to enable women in general to get what is beneficial to her and to benefit her family and her own men. So that is basically the code, the explanation will come out in a book, inshallah, and this is an advertisement for the book, because it will probably take me a year and a half to publish it. So you would have forgotten about this whole thing. But I'm trying to say that this code needs to be explained in a book, because under each, you know, clause here, there is so much explanation and there is so much proof that went into the making of this, of the recommendations. These are just certain statistics or news that I have for your consideration here. This was from the Associated Press, single-sex classroom gaining favor, advocate site, less disruptions, higher test scores. And this was in Kentucky, and it says here that the social studies teacher, whatever. Anyway, it's just like, you get the point here. This was from, the other one was from CNN. Same-sex education gets boosted by Bush plan. And certainly, the issue here is that you may want to hate the Republicans all the time, but the idea here is we don't have dogmatic beliefs. Like, we're not going to, you know, like everything the Democrats do versus the Republicans just because of some dogmatic position. Republicans sometimes are a lot more reasonable than Democrats in many areas. Yes, they may be more conservative, more, you know, rough against minorities, more rough, but in terms of sensibility, particularly in social matters, it's quite obvious that they are more sensible in that particular regard. This was from the Rape of Youth Incest National Network. And in 2001, and you can certainly Google this, and you'll have a lot more statistics than I can show here. quarter million victims of rape in the U.S. And attempted rape or sexual assault. Of these, of this quarter million people, 102,000 were victims of sexual assault. 63,000 were victims of attempted rape, and 84,000 were victims of completed rape. These figures do not include victims 12 years or younger. The Justice Department has estimated that one of six victims are under the age of 12. One out of every six American women have been the victim of an attempted or completed rape in their lifetime. 14.8% completed, 2.8% attempted. A total of 17.7 million women have been victims of these crimes. About 44% of rape victims are under age 18. 3 out of every 20 victims are under age 12. 7% of girls in grades 5 to 8 and 12% of girls in grades 9 through 12 said they have been sexually abused. Approximately 66% of rape victims know their assailant. In other words, it is a consequence of social mingling. It's a consequence of lack of restrictions. You know, send your daughter for a sleepover at someone's house, and, you know, the brother of that friend rapes her. This is not someone in the street. That's 66% of someone they knew. Family member, acquaintance, neighbor, friend, etc. Approximately 48% of victims are raped by a friend or acquaintance, 30% by a stranger, 16% by an intimate, 2% by another relative, and in 4% of the cases, the relationship is unknown. 61% of rapes, sexual assaults, are not reported to the police. Those rapists, of course, never serve a day in prison. So the numbers that you have heard are the reported numbers. 61% of rapes and sexual assaults are not reported. In America, a woman is raped every 2 minutes. National Coalition Against Domestic Violence website says 1/8 of homicides are a man killing his wife. 6% of women are hospitalized for depression during their adulthood. This may not be quite relevant. This is also not quite relevant. This is the Harvard president, Warren Summers, and his statement about, you know, maybe we should find what women are better at so that we're not wasting resources trying to get them into nuclear physics when they may be better at humanities. But the issue here is separation between, after having read this for you, let's have a little bit of a discussion. The issue here of separation between men and women, this is not a matter of segregation, like segregation on racial or national or socioeconomic basis. This is because there is chemistry, there is biology. There is, just like wine, he can't say that I will drink a glass or two of wine and stop. You may not be able to stop. You cannot tame the beast, therefore you have to stay away from the beast completely. Therefore Allah says, "Fajtanibuhu," avoid it completely. 0%. There has not been a nation in the whole world that was able to tame the beast of wine and to confine it within that context of social drinking. It doesn't happen. And it's not about you and me. It's not about individuals. And Allah legislates. He legislates for the creation. He does not legislate for Hassan. He legislates for the Ummah, for the people. So if Hassan can control himself, you know, make it permissible, this very thing, yes, Hassan can control himself. But guess what? There are 99 other people that will not be able to control themselves. And those 99 other people will come and hit Hassan by the car because they were driving under the influence. So it is not going to only affect them, but it will affect Hassan as well, whether he likes it or not. The issue here is, and maybe I should show you this, there are certain things that you cannot, like we said before, if you have a slippery slope and steep inclination or angle, then it is impossible for you sometimes to stop when you're so far down. The only way for you to stop is to stop at the top, not the bottom. One of those things is the very issue that we're talking about now, which is the issue of separation between the two different genders, or two different sexes. By the way, the word gender I use is quite, you know, they get you to use it, but it was meant to actually blur the differences between the two different sexes. In this particular regard of separation between women and men, segregation does not mean inequity. Segregation would mean inequity if it was on different bases. The most prevalence of HIV in the whole world, and this is from the WHO, the source here is the WHO, the WHO, the World Health Organization that belongs to the United Nations. And if you look at the Area 1040, you'll find that within the Area 1040, you have the lowest prevalence of HIV in the entire world. Right? What's the Area 1040? 10 below the equator to 40 above the equator. In Asia and Africa, that's the area that's predominantly inhabited by Muslims. That's right or wrong. That's the area that the Christian missionaries used to call, you know, the toughest, the hardest area to work in. And that's where it earned the name 1040. It earned the name 1040 from the Christian missionaries. They used to divide the world into areas. So when they talked about the area 1040, they talked about 10 below the equator, 40 above the equator. And why they called it 1040, they gave it a specific name, because of the very great difficulty they encountered spreading Christianity amongst the inhabitants. And that's basically all of this area. So, because if you look at Africa, for instance, because it's the same circumstances, same everything. If you look at Africa, you will find that South Africa, which has a minority of Muslims, the Muslim population in South Africa is certainly, you know, much less than here, much less than up here. So the farther down you go in Africa, to the south, you will find less Muslim concentration. For the very simple reason, which is that the colonialism made it to those places before Islam. Or colonialism even made it after Islam, but was able to convert the native people. So it's quite obvious that, you know, the less Islam, the more HIV. Statistically quite significant. This is statistically extremely significant. You know, the less Islam, more HIV. More Islam, less HIV. And someone can say whatever they want, you know, bigotry and whatever you want, but this is just a fact. And hypocrisy is a different issue. You know, bigotry, if bigotry is about telling the facts, then let's be bigotry. Hypocrisy is about, you know, covering the facts, changing the facts, changing the truth. And that would be certainly worse than bigotry, if speaking the facts would be bigotry. And the reason behind this is this very ayah here, this very concept, this ayah and the previous ayah, the concept of say to the believing men that they should lower their gaze and guard their modesty, and say to the believing women that they should lower their gaze and guard their modesty. It starts there. It does not start at the end when the, you know, fire had already caught on the oil. it starts there at the beginning. And in the Quran, the very expression of the Quran, the beauty of the expressions of the Quran is that you should always ponder over the use of each and every word. When it talked about the prohibition of zina, it did not say do not fornicate, la taznu. It says wala taqrabu zina, don't come near to, don't come close to zina, because it's telling you that you come close, you can't control yourself when you get close. Therefore, you know, don't come close. That is the prohibition. The prohibition was not la taznu. The prohibition is do not come close. Because there are many introductory steps that will lead you into the crime of fornication or illicit sex or illegitimate sex or out of the wedlock sex, etc. And all of those introductory steps must be cut off. And Islam cut them off. You know, there is no seclusion. There is no free, inappropriate mingling. There is no touching. There is lowering of the gaze. Despite all of this, it, you know what? Moderation sometimes makes you contradictory in the perception of people. Makes you, double-faced, contradictory, inconsistent in the perception of people who have less, insight. Why? Because if you're an extremist, it will be quite easy for you to look consistent. Extremist people are quite consistent, by the way. You don't have to weigh anything. Life is not about, you know, absolutism. Life is about consideration of multiple factors and the interplay of all of those factors and weighing the benefit against the harm and trying to come to a moderate position. But if you're an extremist in any particular position, you will look quite consistent. You may look quite good and you may be laughing at everybody else because of their inconsistency. Because, like I said, you know, having said all of this, the women will still need to participate. They were not prevented during the time of the Prophet ﷺ from going out for their needs, from going out to the market, from going out to the masjid, from going out to the battlefield to participate and to contribute to the well-being and the protection of the ummah. So if they were not barred from going out to the battlefield, then this whole issue of, you know, keeping a distance has to be still put in perspective, and you have to look at the two sides of the evidence. And if you look at the two sides, and maybe it may not be a bad idea to show you a little bit of the two sides. If you look at one side, someone would say that the Prophet ﷺ did not have a partition in his masjid. Someone may say that women used to come and ask the Prophet ﷺ and talk to him in the deed and so on, even in the presence of men. Someone may say that, you know, Aisha and Umar and Rubaya and Umm Atiyah and other women used to go out to the battlefield with the Prophet ﷺ. Someone may say that the Prophet ﷺ told us of Umm Shariq, who used to be one of his female companions, and she used to host people at her home. She was an older woman. It is quite obvious from the records that she was an older woman. Someone may say that the Prophet sent a man with one of his companions to their home to be fed, and the companion sat the man in the same room. Him and his wife and the man sat in the same room, and they have dinner in the same room. Yes, certainly, you could say that the man was sitting right next to his wife, and you could say that the wife was next to the end of the room. So it depends on your, or was sitting, you know, on one side of the room, and he was sitting next to the man. So it depends on your, your ability to take in and absorb all of the reports and perceive them through the rest of them, perceive each one of them through the rest. So if you perceive each one of them through the rest, that very story of three being in the same room together, someone who is an extremist in being permissive would say that she was sitting right next to him, you know, next to the foreign man. The hadith doesn't say that. The hadith does say it was the same room, but it doesn't say that. And someone also may say, no, that he actually had a curtain. Well, the hadith didn't say that he had a curtain. But you could say that there was a distance, a reasonable distance. So it depends on... yes, she from behind hijab. And Aisha, even when she made tawaf around the Kaaba, there used to be a hijab, like a piece of, you know, blanket, curtain, or people who were walking next to her with it. So if we take, for instance, so you have the proofs from both sides. These are the evidence used by those who widen the scope of permissibility, and we mentioned some of them, and the evidence of those who narrow the scope of permissibility. It's quite hard for the computer to have the two languages, by the way. You have common affability, you couldn't stay in your houses. You have Al-Kasani. The Hanafis, by the way, used to be quite strict with the issue of mingling. So Al-Kasani says that it's not permissible for young women. He says it was a consensus of their scholars, consensus here of their scholars, to prevent young women from going out to the masjid. That is not correct, because that is, you know, in conflict with the hadith. But this is how far they went. And when you ask them, his wife, the Prophet sent for anything you want to ask them from behind a screen, this is at the hijab. You have the hadith in which the Prophet said the prayer of a woman in the family part of her home is better than her prayer in the formal reception area, and her prayer in her own private quarters is better than the prayer in her family part of her home. That's for more privacy. You have the best of the rows of men is the first, and the last is the worst is the last, and the best of the rows of the women is the last, and the best is the first, with the obvious effect, cause of being far away from the men. You have separation here. Even the older woman, she prayed behind her son. Prophet ﷺ, when he finished with the sleeve, he used to stay to face forward and not turn around. And the Sahaba used to stay seated until the women had left. Specified here, there is this hadith here of Abdullah ibn Umar that they specified a door here for women. During the time of the Prophet Abdullah ibn Umar never entered through this door until he died. There's this hadith which is about Aisha radiallahu anha, making tawaf, but separated from men by a curtain, and many others. However, the issue here is, at the end in the book, we'll talk about the different circumstances, different age groups, different conditions, different circumstances, different handling settings, and so on and so forth. And we'll show pictures, of how to conduct, classes, without a reasonable distance, not preventing the women from the right education at the same time, providing them with some degree of, you know, distance and so on. So the issue here is that in order for you to be moderate, you have to take into consideration all of the truths. And moderation, as Islam describes it, is the panacea of those ailments and diseases. On the one side of compartmentalizing women into like a very, very small sphere in which their abilities and skills and capacities will be suffocated, and on the other side, you know, leading to all of the statistics that you just read on the screen. So I think that the way of moderation is the way of Islam, and it's the right way. And it is not meant at all to belittle the woman. In fact, it was meant to honor her. Jazakumullah khair.